good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in with your questions tonight, although Wally Derleth is our only phone volunteer back there tonight. So please give him a little bit of slack as he's going to be having his hands full as we get through the show. The number to call in tonight is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. But hold off right away on those calls as we have a couple of guests that we're going to be inviting on the show here for a little bit as well. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press. And he's authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back.
Hey, Bill, thanks. And it's refreshing that we are back on schedule. We're supposed to be the second Tuesday of the month, and we weren't in January and February. So 2021 was looking rocky, but we had episodes every month. We just didn't get it when we wanted to. We were postponed by various things, including the big ice storm and some impeachment hearings that were aired. And I'm just happy that tonight is when we're supposed to be on the air and everything's good.
So you could say we had frozen impeachments. Yes. I mean, it was cold and, well, you know, the world was a little bit rocky there. But we are back with our show. So Cliff is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. And again, he will be taking your calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And as always, at the top of the show, Cliff, we recap last month's conservation tip. And could you tell us a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, last month we ended with a conservation tip about estate planning for birds. And if you wanted to make a positive impact to help birds and bird habitat, and don't expect your friends and your family and your heirs to know what that might be, is to consider setting up your estate now, looking at donating a portion of your assets to an organization that protects birds. There are lots of organizations out there. There are websites that actually can help you find the best charitable organization. The two are Charity Watch and Great Nonprofits. These two sites measure a charity's effectiveness, meaning how much of the budget goes to what you want, the dedicated programs and versus overhead. So, and then we also talked about if you own a ranch or a farm and you have lots of kids, lots of heirs, try not to divide that property. It's just, you're going to find that some of the kids want to keep it and some want to sell it, and it just whittles it down, and that leads to fragmentation. So the best thing to do is get with your tax advisor or an estate planner today to discuss how you can set up your estate to protect birds, and that would be a really good thing to do. And while I've got the floor, I wanted to clarify a few things from last month. Bill called asking about a bird that he'd heard about that breeds in Alaska and winters in New Zealand, and I incorrectly said bristle-thighed curlew. That bird breeds in Alaska, but it only goes to Hawaii to winter. The correct name, or the correct species, I goofed. The correct species should have been bar-tailed godwit. It's a different shorebird. So the bar-tailed godwit is what Bill needed to hear. He called asking about a bird that breeds in Alaska, winters in New Zealand. Again, bar, B-A-R, tailed godwit. So also, Bo called last episode asking about cormorants, and I talked about a paper by Thompson. I looked that up. That Thompson is the second author. The first author is Campo, C-A-M-P-O. And there are four or five other authors, including a friend of mine, Ray Telfair. They did a study on the diet of double-crested cormorants, and I got everything pretty well recited in there, but I did a little homework, and I said shad, and that's still correct, but it's mostly gizzard shad and threadfin shad. They accounted for 80% of all fishes eaten by cormorants in their study. And cormorants eat shad, minnows, carp, drum, tilapia, and various other forage fishes. They really don't eat a lot of sport fish. According to the Campo study, the most abundant sport fish was the sunfish, but that was a low number. There were studies in Mississippi and Alabama, and another review conducted in Minnesota. They all found the same thing, that cormorants were not impacting the sport fisheries. And so no one can find a decline of fish attributed to cormorants. But we have found that the declines can be attributed to other factors such as decreasing water levels and golden algae-induced fish kills. So I wanted to just clarify those couple of things, and that's it, Bill.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we will be taking calls shortly at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. But first, we have a couple of special guests. Last month, we had talked about an eagle cam that we had gotten a video link sent to us about this eagle cam that was beautifully right above, the eagle's nest, and you could see down into it. And you could see what's going on. And we actually have the teacher with us right now from a school in Caddo Parish, along with one of her students, 7-year-old Zaid. And they are on with us right now. And I'm going to ask both Louise and Zaid, turn down your radio in the background because we're hearing the playback right now. And you should be able to hear me.
That's it, Bill.
There you go.
All right. You are listening to
Louise, can you hear me? Well, Louise, can you hear me?
How about Zaid?
Zaid, are you there? Well, now that is not good because technology-wise, that's not happening. Zaid and Louise, are you there? Hello, Zaid and Louise? I think they put their phones down. So Zaid and Louise, please get on. And in the meantime, Cliff, what is our profile species this month?
Yeah, tonight we're going to talk about the white-eyed vireo. It's a bird that prefers thickets and dense vegetation, which makes them difficult to see. But they sure make up for it by being persistent, loud songsters, making them easy to hear. They have a great song that's quite variable, so let's listen to three different examples of the white-eyed vireo here. Okay, that was example one. Let's go to example two. And now, how about example three?
Okay.
So sometimes we use mnemonics to describe birdsong, and we often discuss these on our show. To some people, the chips and whistles we just heard has been likened to the catchy phrase, "Quick, go get the beer check." The key here is the quick at the beginning and the check at the very end. One has to have a bit of an imagination with this translation, but it sure can help when trying to memorize the song of this species. A more literal translation for its song might be chick-a-peer-ear-ear-chick. The species is named for the adult's eyes being white in coloration. This vireo is quite small and about the size of a plump goldfinch. Its overall color is mostly olive and gray with prominent white wing bars, yellow spectacles, and a lemony wash on their flanks. One colloquial name is basket bird, named for the small hanging nest it weaves in the shrubs, often at or below eye level, usually found after the leaves have fallen off in autumn. The nest looks like a purse attached at the fork of a small limb and hanging down. These are insectivorous birds, gleaning insects off of leaves. This vireo ranges widely in the eastern half of the U.S. It's one of the most common, abundant songsters in spring and summer in our area as well as across the southeastern U.S. Most migrate south in the winter from Mexico through Honduras, as well as Cuba and in the Bahamas. quite a few overwinter in woodlots and thickets along the entire Gulf Coast. It's not super unusual for a few to winter as far north as here in the Red River Radio listening area. To see a photo of a white-eyed vireo snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right, and hopefully, Louise, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, and Zaid, are you there?
Yes.
All right, so we got our problem. I should have told you all when I faded you down before we started the show that you would be in oblivion there for a few minutes. So. But we are back with our student and our teacher, Louise, from Acato Parish School here, and Zaid, who is, I believe, 7 years old and a student in second grade. And they had this wonderful experience with an eagle cam. And Cliff, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, so Louise called us and talked about, she actually enlightened us. We weren't aware of the eagle cam. It's right here in Shreveport. And she said she's got it on in the classroom. And so I thought, wow, wouldn't that be cool to have her come back on the show with one of her students to talk about what it's like to have the cam going and what they're learning about this eagle nest. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Louise and Zaid, and tell us all about this eagle cam and what it's meant to your classroom.
We started watching before they had their hatched their eggs because I thought we could kind of get used to it before it got too exciting. We could get used to it being there. So we've been watching it. We've watched them hatch. We keep it on all the time. But maybe Zaid wants to talk about what he's seen on there. We see a lot.
Yeah, Zaid, tell us some of the highlights you've seen over the last few weeks or months.
Well, I've learned that the female is bigger than the male. And most of the time, the male gets the fish. I think the female has got a fish one time. And the baby, when he first hatched, had, like, over his eyes, had kind of like a bandit mask.
Huh. And how's he look now? He's getting kind of big and fuzzy gray, isn't he?
Yeah. He has a bitch of patch on under his neck.
Yeah. And every time I look, he looks pretty lazy, just kind of laying on one side like he's just enjoying the sun or the breeze. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, that's what he usually does.
Yeah. Is that what 7-year-old kids do? Do you do a lot of that, laying around and just acting like a baby bald eagle?
Yeah, just popping the couch and watching TV.
There you go.
They're my kind of bird.
There you go. So I've got a question. Do you all know, Louise and Zay, do you all know when I look at night on the cam, is that a light or is that infrared when we're seeing it through the night? What do you know?
I don't think there's a light up there. I think it's infrared.
Okay.
Or night vision or
night
whatever
vision.
It is.
Yeah. But it is cool to go on there at night and see how the adult's sleeping during the nighttime. But what else, Abe? What kind of critters, other than fish, have you seen them bring in to feed? What else have you seen? Any turtles?
Yeah, there's some turtles used to bury in there.
And anything else? Any birds or squirrels or anything like that, or just fish and turtles?
Just fish and turtles.
Yeah. That'd get pretty boring. I'd be eating, like, mac and cheese and hot dogs all the time and nothing else. I'd get a little old, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Louise, what are your students? Are you having them recite anything they've learned or any projects coming out of this? I know that's hard for a second grade class, but I'm sure they're maybe doing pictures or drawings or anything. What all?
Study birds and stuff a lot at school. We mostly the point, I don't know, I just, when I started watching it, you know, I think of myself as an animal lover, but when you watch them all the time, you kind of just really learn to appreciate everything they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I don't know, that's kind of our goal. We definitely will be writing thank you letters to Metro Aviation for setting this up.
Cool.
For people to watch, because, I mean, they're just doing it as a hobby for people to, you know, be able to watch it.
Yeah.
And so we do that. We write about it and we research birds, but I think mainly it's just to appreciate it.
And for listeners that don't know what we're talking about, there's a camera set up on above a nest of active bald eagle nests right here in Shreveport that you can watch 24/7. And all you have to do is go on Google or go on YouTube and just do Metro Aviation Bald Eagle Nest, and boom, it'll come up, and you'll see the live feed of what these birds are doing. So pretty cool. So Zaid, what do you think? Are you going to be sad when the baby grows up and flies off, or what's it going to feel like when he goes away? Are you going to be excited when he flies off, or what's going to happen, do you think?
Hello, Zaid.
Did we lose him?
No, I think he's still there.
Is he still there? Louise, are you still there? Well, maybe we lost him.
Mm, well, their lines are still live. Okay. So, okay. Well, I guess we're going to move on. But Louise and Zaid, I want to thank you very much for joining us for this show. And keep in touch. We'll be back with you, okay?
Yeah, we need more teachers like Louise that are bringing nature into the classroom and teaching kids that these eagles are trying to raise a family just like the rest of us. And we got to give them space. We got to give them respect, and I really like that she's getting that to her students at a young age of age 7. So,
okay, can you hear us again, Louise and Zaid?
Something happened. I guess we lost him.
Yeah, so. Well, I can hear him in the background, but I'm not sure. All right, we want to thank both of you guys for calling in tonight. It's been a fun time.
Yeah.
Of course, technology, well, that's the bane of my existence. But
yeah.
You are listening. Fortunately, birds don't deal with technology. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And while we're waiting for our first set of calls, Cliff, we had some, you got some audio here that you sent in via your phone.
A mystery bird.
And it's
two sound clips, a mystery bird I wanted to play.
All right. Now, these sound like they were taken at nighttime almost.
Nope. Nope. In the day.
Okay.
And don't give them the answer. So I recorded that with my cell phone in my backyard about a week or two ago, and let's hear the second one. So both recordings are a blue jay, and that second one, it sounds very hawk-like. So blue jays can make all kinds of neat sounds. They can sound like a rusty gate opening and make all kinds of gurgles and chuckles, but I wanted to just capture that because and also to remind folks that your cell phone can do a lot. So I have a cheap little it's not cheap, it's a free app on my cell phone that I downloaded, and it's called Easy Voice Recorder, and with a couple quick clicks I can get to recording stuff. And I did that with the blue jay, and I wanted to play those on the air. So those are blue jays, and that was the mystery bird. So
all right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and we have our first call. But right now you can give us a call. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and we're going to go to Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I'm curious about the identification of a hawk that we saw, three or four days ago. We were on going across the north side of town on the loop, and we saw sitting on one of the phone wires just a little bit west of Lowe's a pretty good-sized hawk. And it was... saw him kind of face on, didn't look like his head was real big, had a very reddish breast, and then it looked like kind of a grayish-white under part of the tail.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you had, Clyde, and we often see raptors on poles, on the telephone poles. The larger raptor, red-tailed hawk, often sit up on the poles, but The smaller, with the smaller foot raptor I'm about to name is your bird that will sit on the wires along roadways, and that's the red-shouldered hawk. So this is a large raptor that shouldn't be confused with what we used to call the sparrowhawk or the kestrel. But red-shouldered hawks, I see them a lot. And so when you mention those colors, that fits. When you mention sitting on wire, that fits. They're often over bar ditches along the road or just the road right-of-way in general. So, Clyde, your bird's a red-shouldered hawk.
Okay. Yeah. I have seen kestrels, or American prairie falcons, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
They're dramatic with all those colors.
Yeah, very colorful.
Little bird.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for the call, Clyde. Very good.
Very well. Thanks for telling me what I saw.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. By the way, the bird, the Blue Jays that you just heard, the audio of those are on our website, so you can do some comparison. And as a matter of fact, if you go to our website, redriverradio.org, and go under programs, you'll see it in a menu bar up there, and look for bird calls. You are going to find so many sound files in there that can help you identify birds as you go through your own backyard. And, you know, we tend to try to keep local so that these are birds that, generally speaking, can be heard at different times of year throughout here, whether it's migratory birds or other birds. I don't think we've gotten into that Martian lunar, bird yet. Yeah.
No, what's cool for out-of-staters, people even far away from our listening area, the bird we profiled a few minutes ago, Wadded Vireo, probably occurs in 25 states. Mm-hmm. So we're not just inclusive here. We try to include a lot of stuff here.
And right now we're waiting for our next calls to come through. We've got a couple of pictures here that were sent in from a listener who wrote in, "I'm attaching a few pictures of a small bird that I need help identifying. It has been in my tree a lot this winter and has been a regular at one of my feeders. It is small gray bird with a visible yellow rump. And I believe I may have seen the yellow featured under its wings, small like a goldfinch and constant chirp when it arrives." And that's from Peter from Houston.
Yeah, and his pictures are decent. They're not going to be on the cover of a Nature magazine, but they are decent in that we can tell exactly what this is. And he even got the name in his description because the bird is called the yellow-rumped warbler. The colloquial name is Butterbutt, and some of you might remember that we profiled the yellow-rumped warbler exactly a year ago this month. The yellow-rumped warbler, there are three pictures. It's a very common winter bird here in the South, and kudos to Peter for sending in those pictures so we could identify it. Pictures always help.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we do have callers calling in now. And we're going to go next to Dustin from Hudson. Dustin, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, sir. I do a little bit of, like, wildscaping and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And every once in a while in the spring and the fall, I'll see, like, two or three, sometimes, like, four or five different species of birds kind of come through the area, but, like, kind of all as a group.
Yeah.
Feeding.
Uh-huh.
Is that just something that they do in residential areas, or is that actually like a normal thing that you would see like out in the Angelina National Forest or whatever?
Yeah, it depends on the species. Some are just naturally going to be flocking together, and another thing could be that they're all experiencing that magnet attraction, like to your wildscape. You might be bringing birds together that maybe normally wouldn't be, but so it just depends on the species. If you're able to tell us any of the species, we could maybe talk about each one. But it's not really a one size fits all with migratory birds. A lot of birds travel in groups and flocks, and a lot of species don't.
Well, it's like always there's just the titmouse. The titmouse is always hanging out and squawking at everybody, and it'll be like a titmouse, a house wren maybe, and like a yellow bird and like a blue jay,
yeah,
or like a cardinal and stuff like this.
And most of those are resident birds that you just listed. So titmouse doesn't leave us. So they're here year round, and they're probably not going to be more than, you know, twosies most of the year, and then when they raise young, that number will rise up as they bring in their youngsters and teach them how to be titmice. But yeah, those are going to be usually in family groups, some of those that you listed. Yeah. So that's cool, Dustin, that you're doing some wildscaping. That's a good segue into reminding people to do like what you're doing and to landscape for wildlife, what we call wildscaping. That's planting native plants that are acclimated to our soil and to our climate, and they give back to nature. They're not just green. They're not just showy. They actually provide nectar and seeds or
beauty
fruit
berry.
Or beauty berry.
Everybody loves beauty berry.
Yeah, beauty berry is a great one. And if you want to see a lot of cedar waxwings fighting the resident mockingbird, plant some beauty berry, because that's a great example. And robins also want to eat those berries as well. So wildscaping is a really good thing to do, because it's not just putting feeders out like we experienced with the winter storm. It's also providing these native berry-giving plants, like you mentioned. Usually beauty berries, though, they're stripped clean before the new year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're usually way gone. So
do we get orioles down here?
We do.
I've seen like black and orange birds that are kind of medium sized.
Yeah, we'll get orioles in migration. The Baltimore Oriole is a very rare local nester in the listening area, but they're a very common spring uncommon spring and fall migrant. And so you can see those. They look like butterflies. They're just so orange and black. They're beautiful.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
Thank you guys.
Thank you, Dustin.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John from Fishville, you are on next with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I've got kind of a quickie.
You might want to turn down your radio in the background.
Yeah.
Well, that must be an echo. I don't have the radio on at all.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a phone echo then.
Yeah. Cliff, what I have here, I'm out in the middle of the timberland in central Louisiana, and they're clear cutting about 2,000 acres right up against my front yard. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm already seeing all the raccoons and possums and all that stuff migrate into my place.
Yeah.
What kind of birds can I expect, or is there anything that might be a problem with that kind of change of lifestyle for them?
Well, what was there before? Was it just a monoculture of pine trees in there? Were they harvesting just pine, or was it a hardwood side, or what?
Mostly pine. There's a few hardwood.
Okay.
It's mostly pine, yeah.
Yeah. What you're going to notice on that side across the fence is, over the next few years, what we call those species that are attracted to the early successional stage of the forest that comes back. Things like indigo and painted bunting and prairie warbler, and there's a lot of birds that are going to really move in there, and they'll be in there for a few years until those pine. I'm expecting that they replanted to pines, and when those pines get to be looking like a Christmas tree farm and getting a little too tall for Christmas trees, then a lot of those species will vacate, and it won't have the diversity that it did in the beginning, and it won't until it becomes more of a mature stand, 35, 40 years and up, and with some management that includes basal area reduction, meaning a thinning, meaning getting rid of maybe half of the stems so the trees are allowed to get bigger and allow some light to get to the ground. You can have all kinds of good stuff in there if the management is done properly. If they just cut it and walked away and they let it just grow up as is, it's going to be a thickety mess for a while as all the plants are trying to scramble and get their footing and hog the light and try to command that area and grow and not get shaded out. It's just fighting for that spot, and these plants are all about trying to stay alive and get plenty of sun.
Yeah, and they don't manage that land at all. It's it's just wild.
Okay, yeah, and I mean, there'll still be some birds that utilize that when it comes back up, but it's unfortunate that they're not going to really prep it and keep it managed to what we call a open pine stand that's really lacking in our area and very beneficial to a lot of birds.
Well, they do claim they're going to replant, but it's only going to be pine.
Yeah.
And they don't get in there and do any cleaning, any trimming. It's just wild.
Right, right. And trimming and cleaning isn't, you know, it's not a manicured golf course. That's not what I'm referring to at all.
Yeah.
It's more of a just keeping the less mouths to feed, so to speak, by not overstocking it and having it more open. The trees are spaced farther apart. And when the trees are tall enough, you can start implementing prescribed fire. That's super important for a lot of birds to have that grassy, herbaceous understory layer that's used to be part of this area, and it's almost gone. It's an endangered species, that plant community. So,
yeah.
Well, good.
Will there be any more predator types? I've got chickens and everything out here on the farm, and I kind of worry about the predator. Will there be an increase of predators, you think?
Well, another bird that comes into the clear cuts and likes to be a brood parasite of a lot of those birds I listed is the brown-headed cowbird. So it's not a predator what you're thinking of, you know, eating on these birds, but it instead lays eggs like a foster parent, or expects the recipient of the egg to be a foster parent of the cowbird egg.
Oh,
so
interesting.
So cowbirds are attracted to those early successional stands. You'll see them more than in a dense forest, for sure.
What size bird is that? The
cowbird is smaller than a red-winged blackbird. He's in the blackbird family, so smaller than a robin, roughly bluebird-sized.
Okay.
And very, very bland. Kind of gray in the female, gray brown, and a little bit darker in the male, with a shiny glossy body, and then all of a sudden his head is a different color and it's a flat brown, and that's where he gets the name brown-headed cowbird. That brown, flat brown, really stands out to the glossy black of the rest of the male.
I'll have to keep an eye out for that one.
Yeah. Okay, John. Well, thanks for the call.
Hey, man. Thank you. Okay. You really are on top of this.
Oh, great. Thank you, sir.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have a caller call in from Leesville and wanted to know what happened to the other egg in the eagle's nest. Now, I brought up the video earlier, which we had, and this is from all the way back in January when these scenes were shown, and you can see two eggs there. But later on, as he had said, it looked like one egg. Well, there's two eggs there. But he didn't know, and I thought, well, maybe a predator or something like that. But I don't worry.
Well, we talked about that with Louise. She said a third eagle came in, and there was a tussle and a bunch of big-footed birds walking around, and one of the eggs
squash
got kicked, stepped on, poked, punctured. We don't really know, but it was never viable after that little fighting that was going on with this third unknown eagle. So that's why there's one. That's a good comment from that Leesville caller, because most bald eagles do raise two young. So this one is one young because of that tussle that happened several weeks ago, many weeks ago.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Shannon from Converse, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, hello. I was wondering about red-headed woodpeckers.
Okay.
I think I had one. Do they have white spots on their black feathers?
On the back, they do. They have kind of looks like a white backpack on a black body.
Okay, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I had one in my yard.
Cool.
And I've had it for 3 days now.
Uh-huh.
And it keeps going to the sheds out there and pecking on the metal.
Okay, probably drumming on the metal, which is different than pecking. Pecking is just a peck, peck, peck. Drumming is a brrrr. Yeah, and that's a form of communication. So he's not doing that to cause damage. He's doing that to tell other woodpeckers, hey, man, this is my home. I live here. So he's using that as a form of communication.
And I was also going to ask, what kind of food is the best kind of food to feed them? The sunflower seeds or the wild bird seeds?
The best food is just to keep your trees, and they're going to find a lot of stuff up in the trees. If they're desperate, they will come down to black oil sunflower seed on a feeder. Okay. And you will see that happen with red-headed woodpeckers, but they are finding plenty of stuff. And now that it's warming up, they do a lot of fly catching, a lot of insect eating. So they're one of the stranger woodpeckers in that they'll sally out often on an insect that's flying away, and they'll pursue it. Most woodpeckers don't do that. So you'll see red-headed woodpeckers pursue insects in flight that they flushed, and we call that sallying out or sally forth. So, yeah, that's a great bird, the red-headed woodpecker, and it's so beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Very cool. And are you Converse, Texas?
Converse, Louisiana.
Louisiana, okay. Well, there's a town both states
I think
have.
We're even smaller than the Texas.
Okay.
Converse.
Yeah. All right. Well, great, Shannon. Thank you for the call. Appreciate
You're
that.
You're very welcome, and I appreciate y'all answering. And have a good night.
Okay, thank you. And Bill, I was going to say, if Louise or Zaid wanted to call in and tell us more about that second egg, the disappearance of, my little quick Cliff Note synopsis might not be accurate. So Louise or Zaid, call us and tell us more about that missing egg in the Eagle Cam, if you'd like.
And the number is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 if you'd like to call in, Louise or Zaid or anybody else right now. And we do have two callers online. Michael from Bossier City, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, yes, Cliff. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My daughter and I were walking out in our yard earlier this week, and we noticed that there was a bird. It looks like a yellow cardinal.
Oh.
It has red tip on its wingtips, red splotches on its wingtips. And none of us have ever seen this bird before, so we were wondering, what kind of a bird is that?
A yellow cardinal. So tell me more about it. What did the head look like? Like, was it smooth-headed, or did it have a tuft or a crest on top of the head, or what?
I think he dropped. So, are you still there, sir? Okay,
I can't hear you,
so Michael, are you back on the phone? Well, that's a heck of a delay. So there you go. So he must have tuned out just to go ahead and hear your answer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are examples of aberrations in cardinals. Somebody sent me the coolest one. A buddy of mine sent me a photo of a backyard cardinal someone photographed in Pennsylvania that was what we call a bilateral gonander morph, which means it's got male features on one side red and female features on the other side, cut right down the middle from top to bottom. And so he's male on one side, female on the other. I don't know. There are some examples of xanthic cardinals, or more commonly leucistic cardinals. But I was trying to make sure that he didn't see maybe a summer tanager female is why I wanted to hear more about what the head looked like. Because we had a record number of summer tanagers wintering in our area. David Wolf keeps track of bird records in the Nacogdoches-Lufkin area, and I think he was up to 5 different backyard birders and area bird watchers that had found 5 different summer tanagers. So that could be a yellow cardinal to some. It would not have a crest. It would be round-headed. So, Michael, if you're still listening, look up female summer tanager, and that would be a bird without a crest. If your bird had a crest and it was yellow, then it would be what we call a leucistic, which is kind of a white whitening. But if it was truly yellow, we'd call that xanthic, X-A-N, Xanthic, T-H-I-C, and those are just plumage aberrations, and they're pretty unusual.
Well, it's curious. Could it have been an oriole? You know, I mean, orange, red, if the sun's shining on it just right, it could make it come out as yellow.
Yeah, and an oriole would be more unlikely this time of the year if he has seen it recently. So, yeah, it's too bad we couldn't hear more about it, but I'm guessing it's probably a summer tanager if it didn't have a crest.
And whenever you get a chance, try to take pictures of those or gather sound. Yeah. One good way to gather sound is to literally turn on your recorder on your phone, and most phones can get an app for recording, and literally put it outside under a tree and walk away for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then we can forage, you know, we can ferret out the bird sounds. But if you walk away, they're more likely to chirp than if you're standing there under it saying chirp.
Right.
Because birds don't perform on cue.
And back to the yellow cardinal, you know, we all don't agree on colors often. So if it was kind of a tan, buffy color, but with the orangey-red beak, that's the female cardinal. So I'm not going to rule out that it wasn't a female cardinal. Some people might think it looks yellow. I don't. It doesn't look yellow to me. But I've noticed that colors can be very subjective. So anyway, so Michael, you've got some homework to do there.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, so you'll get right in. We just have one caller online right now, Jim from Lufkin. You are on with Cliff, and what's your question?
Hi, Cliff.
Hey, Jim.
I have a large American holly tree and a fairly large Yaupon holly.
Okay.
They have an abundance of beautiful red berries. I've never seen any birds eating these berries. I was just wondering why.
And there's still red berries on it after that freeze? I bet you not. No way. I saw red berries that have turned to mush. I could even smell them in one of our trees where the robins couldn't eat them fast enough. The freeze hit, the berries burst, and they got rotten really quick. So I'm betting if you go out there right now, Jim, because Lufkin got as cold as knack with that February 16th low, we got to 1 degrees. I bet you got to 3. You don't have any red berries. If they're not already eaten by all the hungry cedar waxwings and robins, they're toast. They're mush.
But I hadn't noticed any bird activity even before the freeze when there were red berries on the tree.
Well, that's just because they hadn't found you yet. You know, in urban areas, there are a lot of people like you with a Yaupon holly and an American holly and the non-native holly, and there's lots of berries. And that's good because we were seeing lots of birds trying to find food during the freeze. But by now, and that freeze has been past tense enough that those berries are toast. They're no good right now. So I think the answer is they just didn't find you yet.
Under normal conditions, they would eat those.
Yeah, these birds that are eating fruit are nomadic in winter. They're wandering widely because once they strip a tree in the neighbor's yard, that tree's no good till another growing season. It's going to be another 10 to 12 months before they can come back to that tree, right? So they have to wander widely in search of food. And I wanted to mention that people have been saying they're not seeing any robins around, and did the freeze kill them? There were bird deaths, that's no question, but a lot of these birds got out of here. They left. And so robins, I think they cleared the cupboard, so to speak, in our area, and so they have moved on. I think that they just didn't find yours, Jim. So I don't know. I don't know how to put a neon sign on your trees for next year, but we just got to let birds do their thing and find it on their own. So,
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Shannon from Converse is back with us. I've got a follow-up question. Hi, Shannon.
Yes. Yes, hello.
Hey.
The robins he was just talking about, there is plenty in my yard.
Okay.
Over here in Louisiana.
Okay.
There's a lot, and they're getting worms and such.
Oh, good, good.
But my question is, when should I put, yesterday I put out hummingbird food. Is that too early?
At my latitude, I'm in Nacogdoches. That'd be equal to roughly Alexandria.
That's a little bit southern than me.
Okay. I mean, March 16, 17, 18 is usually about when the first male ruby throats come through. So the answer to your question, it's a little early, but there's always early birds and anomalies, and so not all the ruby throats read the book, the guide manual.
Yeah, they never go the same way.
No. So, put it out now. The good thing is with the cooler temperature, the nectar will last a lot longer than, say,
that's what I
August.
Thought, too. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. So good luck with your feeder, Shannon. And I think if you just wait another, 7 days, I think you could see your first male ruby throat. Yep.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Because I have so many birds. And I have these blackbirds with blue necks and heads.
Those are probably common grackles.
Well, they eat a lot of food, and
yep.
I feed them every day.
Okay.
Every day I fill them feeders up.
Yeah.
Them birds come in. But you know what's funny is the squirrels come in, and they like bowling for birds.
Yeah. Yeah, they're after that same free meal as well. So very good.
Free food, man.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, thank you all.
Okay, thank you, Shannon. Bye.
All right, thank you, Shannon. And I was wondering if, when we were talking about those berries earlier, if the birds are just bar hopping,
that's what they're kind of doing.
Yeah.
And they're going to the bar till the bartender says we're completely dry. We don't have any more beverages, no more spirits to serve. So they've got to hop to the next bar.
We've got to teach them how to tailgate next.
Yeah, there you go.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we're getting close to the end of the show, but we still have time for a couple of more calls. So give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. LaTanya from Shreveport, you are on with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, LaTanya. Can you hear me? Well, I'm not sure where that went to, but we're going to go ahead and, LaTanya, if you're listening to the radio, give us a call back at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we've got another caller online. Not sure who it is, but we're just going to go to you. Hello, you're on with Cliff. What's your name, and can you ask your question? Hello? Hello?
We got some technical difficulties this
episode. Well, I'm not sure
whether
that's technical difficulty. So, Kirk or Kurt, are you there? Hello?
They can't hear us.
Okay. Well, that's curious. Let's try it over on this one. Can you hear us now, Kurt? Kurt? Okay. Well, we're having some troubles there with their phones, which is why birds stay in the trees and not in technology.
It fits with COVID and snowvid and now phonevid.
Icevid and everything else. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. Now, 800-552-8502. Now, the robins usually come down here and stay for a lot of the winter, do they not?
Yeah.
But with that cold freeze, that just drove them out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they ate everything. Birds don't just sit around hoping that food will just magically appear. And the thing with robins, if they're not eating berries and other fruit, they're looking on the ground, the exposed ground, for things in the ground like earthworms, and they couldn't do that when there was 3 inches of ice and snow on the ground. So robins did not like it when the ground covered up with ice and snow. They do not like that.
All right, and we're waiting for our next calls to come in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. So with this bird cam, this eagle cam, you're saying that basically, that egg kind of got squashed.
It didn't literally get squashed. It just got bumped or punctured. Louise didn't mention that it was flattened with, like a scrambled egg. To me, it sounded like the birds abandoned it. They know something that we don't. Maybe the camera can't pick up a little puncture hole, but there was a tussle among the three eagles, the two adults and an intruder. That came in and messed things up. So, yeah. Another thing I wanted to mention about the winter storm, a couple things, is that Parks and Wildlife started an iNaturalist program that you can Google. If you go look for an iNaturalist and look for, quote, Winter Storm Uri wildlife deaths, end quote, you can submit records of birds you found dead during the storm. Preferably, if you've got pictures, that would be nice. No one likes to see dead birds, but at least we can see that the idea is correct. And so a lot of people submitted that to that project, and you can also go into that iNat project on your own. You don't need permission, and you can look at what other people have submitted, and it's pretty interesting.
All right, and we do have two callers on back again with us. Marcy from Shreveport, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. During COVID, my 18-year-old son and I have been home a lot, and we both have really gotten interested in watching the birds like everybody else. And he has really gotten into it. And he's gotten books, and he goes out to the Red River Refuge, you know, at different times of the day to see what birds he can see. What else is available in the area as far as groups for people who are interested in bird watching? What could I push him toward?
How old is he?
He's 18.
Oh, he's 18. Okay, he's a big boy then. I mean, the bird study group, it's the local bird watcher club here in Shreveport. Just Google bird study group. Now,
website, and I pulled up some of their information and I printed it off for him. And
okay.
Great information. I just didn't know if they were still active.
Well,
in their bird watching.
Nobody is now. With COVID. None of these groups are active. They've just pretty much shut down, including my local Audubon chapter, Nacogdoches and Lufkin. So I think you're just going to have to wait for COVID to go away before you're going to see any big changes, okay?
So he can go to that website, and that would be a good starting point for him.
Yeah, and also the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, there's a lot of good stuff there that he should jump into. They even have a course in ornithology that is worth taking.
All right, and we want to thank you. We've got one more caller to get in before we go to our conservation tip, and this is Kent from Bossier. Kent, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you. I when the freeze happened, I saw a lot of birds. I live in the country, and I have a Chinese tallow tree, and it seemed like to me just an absolute swarm. I don't know, 100 birds at a time attacked that tree, and you could almost hear them pecking at it, and they wiped out everything up there. And so I wanted to ask you what you thought maybe those were, those birds. But the other thing is that I saw a lot of cardinals, but I also saw this bird that to me looked like the size of a quail. And I saw 4 or 5 of them. Would I have seen quail? I mean, this is not something I normally see.
Probably not. But the only comment I'm going to make about the tallow tree is this. Boo. It is one of the worst non-natives that we can have in the South. And I, you know, what happens is those birds, unbeknownst to them, they're hungry. They are eating those seeds, flying over yonder and pooping. And guess what they're doing? They're spreading tallow. And there are so many problems with tallow trees. I don't even have time to get into it. But if it was me, I'd cut that damn thing down. I'm sorry to say, cut the tallow down, put something native that's got berries, and let birds feast on natives. But let's don't continue the spread of tallow. So
how do you kill tallow trees? How do you get rid of them?
Yeah, you got to kill it by first of all cutting it down, and every time it comes up, you just keep yanking at it. I'm doing the same thing with Bradford pear, crepe myrtle in my yard, and several others that you just have to be vigilant.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Kent.
Yeah, that sounds like there's a tree down in the Everglades that they've been trying to get rid of for years. They put it in initially back when they were draining the Everglades because they thought they were going to, you know, go ahead and develop all that area when Miami was early. And it's from Australia, and the thing just...
Eucalyptus.
No, it's another tree, but it's... Okay. And I forget what the name of it is, but you just cannot get rid of it. You can't burn it out because it just soaks up water. That's what it does. It just soaks up water all day long, and you can't cut it with, you know, saws or anything else. It's just a miserable tree. So, all right, that has been our edition of Bird Calls, and as usual, we end our show with a conservation tip. And Cliff, what do you have for us this month?
Yeah, we're going to talk about neonicotinoids, also called neonics, and they are our country's most widely used insecticide. They were first introduced in the U.S. in 1994 and are now found in hundreds of products. Neonics are used as a seed coating treatment, and they're also sprayed on many fruits and vegetables during the growing season. Neonics persist in our water and soil, and they play a major contributing role in pollinator and bird declines. Neonics are used in high concentrations in the coatings of seeds used to grow corn, canola, sunflower, soy, and other vegetables. For products such as corn, it's nearly impossible for farmers to buy seeds that are not treated with this pesticide. Neonic seed treatments are absorbed by the entire plant and transported to every part, including the roots, stems, leaves, flowers, as well as pollen and nectar. Neonics are persistent in the environment. They infiltrate the groundwater, and they have a cumulative and largely irreversible effect on invertebrates. Recent publications show the negative impacts of neonics on other critters, including fish, reptiles, frogs, and mammals. Earthworms, which are important to birds like robins and woodcock, can die by even low doses of neonics in their system. These insecticides can impact our food web. Neonics are harming the diverse wildlife that pollinate our crops and control our insect pests. Neonics are lethal to birds and to the insects that consume them. The birds that they consume. A single seed treated with neonic is enough to kill a songbird. Lesser amounts can cause severe weight loss in the bird that can impact reproduction and disrupt their migratory tendencies. A study in the lab using white-crowned sparrows that involved feeding tiny neonic-treated canola seeds to this species resulted in all birds suffering significant impairment to orientation and the loss of up to 25% of their fat stores and body mass. Fat stores, by the way, are extremely important for birds because that's what powers them during migration and during long cold snaps like winter storms Uri and Viola that hit the U.S. last month. Neonics are pervasive in our human food supply as well. Evidence on human health risks from neonics is mounting, particularly for infants and children. In addition to the thousands of acute poisoning cases reported the EPA, chronic neonic exposure may be linked to autism spectrum disorder, memory loss, and other adverse developmental and neurological outcomes. Some local jurisdictions in the U.S. have taken action to limit the use of neonics. The European Union has banned three common neonics. We can all help to reduce the prevalence of neonics and their impacts on birds and other wildlife. Read the label before buying plants at stores. Some companies label plants if they have been treated with neonics. Eat more organic fruits and vegetables, and above all, speak out to your elected officials. Do it for the birds.
All right, and I want to thank you again, Cliff, for joining us and being our resident expert on bird calls.
Great. Thank you, Bill.
And hopefully it'll be a warmer couple of weeks before our next show, but the bugs are going to be coming out soon, and we know what that means. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this show. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. The producers are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and Wally Derleth was handling the phones tonight. The three sound files used in tonight's profile species were from xenocanto.org, and in chronological order, they were recorded by Paul Marvin, Russ Y., and Mike Nelson. And this month's bird photos, once again, shot by James Childress, who I'm envious of. And the audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website here in just a few hours. And remember, if you have a photo of a bird that you would like to submit for the show, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us next month for the joint adventure that we call the Birds and the Bugs Show, or the Birds and the Bees Show, with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden as they team up to discuss why their relative creatures are annoying each other. Give us a call at that time and stay tuned. Radio Lab is next. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public media service from LSUS. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado, Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore.